Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I'm John Batchelor, continuing with Professor Richard Epstein of the Civitas Institute. His new book, The Myth of Birthright Citizenship, What the 14th Amendment Really Says. We begin with the 14th Amendment that is into law after the Civil War as a reaction to the tragedy of slavery, of abolition, of the Confederacy, of the violence, of the loss of life. And yet the 14th Amendment is more controversial today than it ever was at the time. Why? Because the understanding of who is a citizenship, who is a citizen, and who is born here, and who is naturalized, and who he or she is parents are at the time weighs in. And we're going to turn to why this controversy is especially difficult because of a decision made by the Supreme Court in 1898, and the majority decision written by a distinguished jurist and Associate Justice Horace Gray, a man who joined the court in 1882, which was the date, coincidentally, of the Chinese Exclusion Act. That also is a matter here, as the professor has pointed to, racial discrimination being a major component of many of the laws and acts passed by Congress ever since the original Constitution. So we're coming to what, Professor, thank you very much. Your book is in dissent of the understanding that there is plain meaning in the 14th Amendment. Horace Gray also came up against the 14th Amendment on a case to deal with a child born here of parents from China. What was that case, and how did Horace Gray resolve it? Thank you.
Well, the case itself was somebody who was born in the United States. His parents were permanent legal aliens. They were not citizens. And what happened is the boy, when he left the country, carried with him a passport from China. And the immigration statutes at the time and the Constitution made it impossible for any person who was of Chinese or Asian descent to become a citizen of the United States because of the two prohibitions. It also turns out at the same time, the United States adopted as a political matter the rule that if, in fact, we give a promise to a Chinese person legally in the United States that he may come back, the doctrine of sovereign immunity means that we could turn that person away. That is not necessarily a result. You could always say that the sovereign was bound by its own promises, but they didn't do that. So when he comes back the second time, what the government does is says, you can't come in this country because we just don't want you. And so Gray could have said, well, he's entitled to return.
This is United States versus Kim Ark.
And so what they said is, he could have said, well, you've promised to let him in as a permanent legal alien. He comes back in as a permanent legal alien. But they didn't say that. What they said is, if you go back and you look at the cases in the 1930s, you see a very common phenomenon. Lots of people come in from overseas who are eligible to be naturalized, and they don't go through any ceremony because they just don't care about it. And all of those people eventually became citizens. And what they did is they used a rule similar to that, like for common law marriages. You've been here long enough. You were eligible for citizens. You've raised your family here. We don't want to treat you as aliens. So what will happen is we'll give you a kind of adverse possession. You've done this long enough. You can do it. And that's what he wanted to do in the Chinese case. The problem is there's one critical difference. All of these people were eligible for citizenship, and they forgot to apply. In Wong Kim Op, he was not eligible for citizenship. So even if he had applied, he would have been turned down. And so the rule on adverse possession never applies if, in fact, the formalities don't allow you to become a citizen. And Gray completely missed the difference between people who came in from Europe who were eligible for citizenship and didn't file, and people who came in from Asia who were not eligible for citizen, and it doesn't matter whether they file or not. So we got everything wrong. You then go back and you look at the actual text. It has nothing to do with domicile, that is a permanent location. It just simply says you have to be resident in the United States, and you don't have to have a permanent detention attachment to any state at any location. Well, once he says it that way, everybody essentially assumes that the original text does not matter, the statutes don't matter, and so forth. And what the government argued was, look, apply this rule of Gray, and all those people coming in for Asian are transient persons. So they're not permanent aliens. Their children don't get citizenship. And all the people who land on the beach, they're illegal, so they don't get citizenship. And the government wanted to argue within Wong Kim Ark. And then the whole case blew up when the language was cited to them about the importance of the Gray Rule, which said that every person who was born in a country is in fact a citizen of it, whether or not he's there legally or not. That was, by the way, the English rule. Nobody ever disputes that. But then you read the same text in context of international law. There's a famous man named Battelle, basically a Swiss who wrote the most important treatise on the nature of citizenship and of nature, and in 1758. And he said the rule everywhere else but England was the one that I mentioned to you. You're only a citizen of the state where your parents apply. And then when you look at all the cases from the earlier period to which our friend Gray was referring, they were all state law cases. They had nothing to do with the federal law. So you had left the country in return. Could the local state let you inherit property? Could the local state let you vote? Could the local state let you sit on a local council? And the federal tests are utterly irrelevant to that. And there is some language in one or two of those cases which says that birthright citizenship may apply. The interesting thing, there's not a single case that I've been able to attack, which is actually given a case where somebody wants to become a birthright citizen and stay in the United States. The closest that you have to it is somebody wanted to inherit property that was left to her by a father who had been briefly in the United States, who had never sought citizenship. And the rule at that particular time in New York State was no alien can sue in order to recover real or personal property. That's how important the citizenship line turned out to have been. And so what happened is they pretended she was a citizen so she could inherit it. And several years later, they allowed aliens to basically inherit property like anybody else.
Professor Horace Gray had a dissent. There was a dissent on that court, Associate Justice Fuller. A dissent can weigh in on this matter that as decided by the Supreme Court today. We don't know what they're going to say. But the Fuller dissent characterizes the Horace Gray mistake and qualifies, I think, the conclusion that you say was drawn from Horace Gray. Is that correct?
That was Melville Fuller. He was actually the Chief Justice, and Justice Harlan, the man of the colorblind constitution, joined with him. And what they did is they went back and they checked all the original sources on this, including those sources which had to do with the administration of justice in the period following the Civil War. And it was very clear that when the government administered this test, being born illegally in the United States did not get you citizenship for any relevant purpose. What you had to do is to go back to the language that I referred to. You're a citizen if you're born a subject to the United States or fully naturalized. Otherwise, you just have transient jurisdiction. So it wasn't as though that was the whole period. And then afterwards, there was a big debate about the way in which this thing was done. And as you get into the 20th century, there's a notorious, utterly indefensible decision by Justice William Brennan, who always made things up when it was suited his purpose. And he had a case called Plowler and Doe, in which he said that the Equal Protection Clause said that even if you were an illegal alien, you were entitled to an education on the same terms as the child of a legal American person. Now, this is just sheer fantasy. The thing to understand about the Equal Protection Clause is it only had to do with criminal matters, and that the basic situation was that all civil matters were decided either under the Citizenship Clause or under the 1866 Civil Rights Act. He did not understand that. And so what he does is he says, you could use a clause that was only concerned with criminal matters to resolve civil matters. The key understanding about the 1866 debates is that the Supreme Court took the position that the distribution of public benefits by the state to individuals was no matter of judicial importance. It was left to the political branches entirely. And one of the reasons why they got the 14th Amendment through, shocking as it is to many people today, is that the supporters of the amendment made it very clear that being a citizen did not give you the right to vote. And so what happened is all voting requirements were left to the hands of the state, which is why you got Southern segregationists running the system for a very long period of time. That was the frame of mind that they had. And there's no question that they did not think that segregated schools or segregated galleries were a real problem. That was to be left to the political system. Now, what happened is by the time you get to the 1890s, the Equal Protection Clause ceases to apply only to all people. It now applies to citizens in one way, other people other way. And they then start to say, in effect, that you have to justify any exclusion of blacks under the police power. And in Plessy v. Ferguson, they argued that the police power justified the separation of the races to maintain the stability and good order of the nation. And as that rationale became more and more transparent, what happened is all of a sudden they said, yes, you have to justify segregation by the police power, and you can't do it. So the Equal Protection Clause, which was originally designed to make sure that regardless of the race of somebody in a criminal case, whether they were a plaintiff or whether they were a defendant, they would get the same treatment as everybody else. And that is an enormous advance in the way in which the civil rights laws were to be applied. Instead, what they said now, in effect, it guarantees substantive rights on the distribution of public benefits, which was no part of the original intention. That's why it is that the Brown v. Board decision always raised such hassles, because there was the stronger historical evidence that all of these issues, which were now subject to the Equal Protection Clause, had previously been left to the jurisdiction of the states.
Professor, I want to come up to date, because this is not, again, this is a controversy that is about to be decided by the Supreme Court one more time about who was born here, who his or her parents are, and what the authority is of the United States over such a child. Professor, yes. Richard Epstein of the Civitas Institute. The book is The Myth of Birthright Citizenship. I'm John Batchelor.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.